All right. Topic in this room is the HoneyNet project. For those of you who don't know, it is not a dating service, nor is it a network app for beekeepers. It was funny last night. I don't know. Break. Okay, the jokes are free. You don't have to laugh. All right, but hopefully you'll enjoy this talk. Anyway, I want to introduce Lance Spitzner and Ed Bellis and Bella and crew. I couldn't get all the names, but they're going to tell you how to know your enemy. So a warm welcome for the HoneyNet project.
All right, we've got 90 minutes to cover a lot of information. We're going to go fast and furious. The big thing we're going to focus on today is our Gen 2 technologies, reverse challenge, a lot of the legal issues. We're geeks, we don't know anything about legal issues, but the DOJ does, so we drag his ass with us. What I'd like to do first is whenever we present as a group is to introduce ourselves. You know who you have, and our help coordinate everything with the project. I work with Sun Microsystems on the security problem. Senior things. I've been with the project for about 3 years now, and I'm not the real technical geek. These are all the real technical geeks. They're going to do a lot. Start with you and go down the line. Introduce yourselves.
I'm Richard Salgado from the Computer Crime Section at the Department of Justice. I don't belong as part of the HoneyNet group. I'm working with the Department of Justice, but I walk and go around with these guys quite a bit and talk to the groups they talk to, and I usually hit a few of the legal issues that arise commonly with deployment and development of HoneyBots.
If you guys want to use the mic, you can use the mic.
Sure.
Yeah,
hey, I'm Ed Skotis from Predictive Systems and CounterHack Security. I watch tools, keep up with what's going on in that, and I've been a member of the HoneyNet project since the very early days.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm K2. I work for Core Security. Been with the HoneyNet for a while. Been doing security stuff for a few years. I do lots of little stuff with the HoneyNet. Code some stuff and things like that.
That's very, very focused.
Perfect. I'm Ed Bayless. I work at Indiana University at an advanced network management lab there. And basically, I'm a software geek. In my prior life, I was a network engineer, so I tend to hit a lot of the network side, plus some data acquisition stuff that we've been working on that we'll talk about later.
Hi, I'm Mike Schiffman. Not really a member of the HoneyNet project. I just sort of wandered up here, and Lance let me sit down. But I guess I've written some code, and I spoke yesterday, so here I am.
That was real in-depth.
Hi, I'm Richard Labella from the South Florida HoneyNet Project. I guess you could tell by the shirt, I'm from Miami. And we've been, the HoneyNet Project's been going on for almost a year now, since September 24th, 2001.
Jed Hale, I've been on the project for about a year. I work on data acquisition, data control, specifically using gateway IDS technology like Hogwash and the new inline snort stuff.
Hi, my name is Rob Lee. I'm one of the newest part of the alliance out here. I'm deployed a wireless HoneyNet in the DC area, and I work with SAIC, who's a corporate sponsorship for that HoneyNet deployment.
All right, what I'm going to do is kick things off, and then I'm going to hand things on as we go along to the real hardcore geeks that we have all here. Go ahead, next slide. Boom. All right, what we've done is we've just gone ahead and we've introduced ourselves. If you want a copy of the presentation, you go to our website, you can download the very copy of the presentation we're about to give. Go ahead. The plan of attack, we're going to give a little bit about the HoneyNet project, HoneyNet's the enemy, real world hacks, and then learn more. Go back real quick. I'm going to lightly cover the HoneyNet project, who we are, what we do, why, and some of our older technology. That stuff that's been out for a while now. What we're going to do is focus on the new stuff. That's what's really happening. Go ahead. A little bit about the project. Everybody's here is volunteers. We're all volunteer organizations. My voice is open. I'm going to use this. We have no funding. We have no resources. We have nothing. Our business model really sucks.
Everybody's standing. We have a business model?
Yeah. But what we do is we learn about the bad guys and we share everything we learn with the security community. Basically, we're an open source intelligence organization. What we do is we do this by deploying networks around the world to be hacked. We just deploy the stuff, the bad guys hack them, and we watch them. Go ahead. So our mission statement, we actually have a real mission statement, is to learn the tools, tactics, and motives of the Black Hat community and share those lessons learned. Next slide. I really have three goals. One, awareness. The vast majority of the community out there is not aware that they're a target. They don't realize that their XP system sitting at home, their Linux box at home, the small business is a target. Anybody here, they're already aware. That's why you're here. So that really doesn't apply to you. But we want to prove to the large percentage of the community that anybody's a target. For the folks that are aware, such as yourselves, we want to provide information about the bad guys, how they do what they do and why. And then finally, there's a small group of people out there that want to do their own research, and we share with everybody how we find our information about the bad guys, so you can do the same thing too if you want. Go ahead. A little history about ourselves. We actually began informally in April of 99. It wasn't like, oh, hey, let's form this project, let's do all these wonderful things, let's do this and that. It was a small mail list and we grew over time. We didn't even call ourselves a HoneyNet project until June of 2000. We're currently in phase two of a phase three project. What are the three phases? Phase one was from 99 to 2001. It was what we used these first generation technologies. We were basically catching the script kiddies, the automated tools, the worms, and stuff like that. Phase two, what we're in now, we're deploying more advanced technologies. We're incorporating a lot of other organizations, going after more advanced guys. And then about 2003, 2004, we'll hit phase three, where we actually start deploying appliances. People can go ahead and all the stuff is automated, ready to go for you. Go ahead. Some of the unique values of the project. First of all, we're totally open source. Not only do we share everything we do, but almost all of our tools are open source. We capture everything that's happened in the wild, so there's no theory. It's not like when we say, we think the bad guys are doing this, we think the bad guys are doing that. It's, hey, here we saw this, here we saw that. It's happening in the wild. It's happening to you. We're made up of security professionals from around the world. As you can see here, a lot of different talent, so we can plug into these skills whenever we need to. And finally, we have no agenda. We have no employees. We have no product. We have no service. We have really nothing to gain. So whenever we provide information, we can feel very unbiased information. Hear that, or totally made up. We're a nonprofit organization. Like I said, we're about as non-profit as you can get. But we do have a board of directors. Actually, some of them are floating around. Jennifer Granick, George Kurtz, Bruce Schneier, and Elias Levy are on our board of directors to steer us in the right direction. No more than two members from any organization can be a part of the project. That ensures nobody has undue influence. I'm from Sun. We only have two Sun members. We got two from Cisco, things along those lines. One from Core SDI, things along those. Really a diverse set of skills and experiences. You can see that sitting here. And then we work virtually from around the world. We have no office. We're spread out. We have 30, 40, 50 people involved, and all 30, 40, 50 people are in different states, different countries, all part of the world. Go ahead. Anybody have any idea what the value of this number is? Go ahead, raise your hand if you know what the value of this number is. Go ahead. What's that? Oh, directing our 501c3. Basically, what this means is, no, it's not HEX, it's IRS. This means we're tax deductible now. We're an official nonprofit organization. You got a CRAE you want to give us, it's tax deductible. Anything you now donate to the HoneyNet Project is tax deductible. So this means we are now one big tax shelter. But seriously, around, we got points of contact. You got any hardware you want to dump on us, we're more than happy to take it, and you make money by doing it. Starting in 2002, and I'm going to hand the mic off here, to Richard, is we started the Alliance. Not only do we have just the project, but we got HoneyNet projects from around the world.
All yours. Thanks, man. Hi, I'm Richard LaBella. I'm from Miami, Florida. I started the South Florida HoneyNet project September 24th, 2001. That's when I met Lance, and I kicked it off with just getting a bunch of folks in pretty much the South Florida area together, went around to the ISSA, the InfraGuard chapters, and some of the local organizations and even members started donating hardware, and this thing grew, and now we've just got a 42U cabinet with all this hardware, and from there we developed the HoneyNet Research Alliance. And the HoneyNet Research Alliance is it's really great because what it allows us to do, it allows other HoneyNet organizations from around the world to deploy HoneyNets. And the benefit to that is that we all get to learn together, we all get to share ideas, we all get to develop and grow this this technology further, we get to collect all this data, and we centralize all of our data collection to a centralized server, which lets all the other organizations go to the server and then see all the logs, intrusion detection logs, firewall logs. Some people are using IP tables. Some people are using Checkpoint. For example, we use Checkpoint. So we get a lot of different types of opportunities to kind of correlate what all of us are seeing. So that's pretty much what that's about. And you want to hit that slide there, if you don't mind? These are the Alliance members currently we have all around the country. South Florida HoneyNet Project, that's us. NIFTY, which is Ed, right over here out of Indiana University. SAIC Wireless, which is awesome, awesome. That's Rob Lee. Washington, D.C., Net Forensics, HoneyNet, Palladian out of India, Internet Systematics, AT&T Mexico, and we have HoneyNet Brazil and Azusa, which is...
Where's Bill?
Hey, Bill. And so those are our organizations, and we're kind of growing that out. We go, I guess, to 15, right?
Yeah. So you have HoneyNets all around the world.
Yep, okay. So we got HoneyNets all around the world. We'll just keep growing. Hit that slide, please. Thanks. Okay, more about HoneyNets. I'll turn it back over to Lance.
All right, yeah. So basically what we're saying is it's just not the HoneyNet project. You have organizations around the world deploying these HoneyNets, and we're all sharing the information. Any organization is welcome to join. Just go to our website, and there's more information about that. Now we're going to go into actually this technology that we are using to capture the information about the bad guys. Like I said, we're moving fast and furious because what we want to do is focus on the new stuff that we've never presented before, first time today. First of all, what is a honeypot? A honeypot is a security resource designed to be attacked. Its value is being probed, attacked, or compromised. A honey net is really nothing more than one type of honeypot. There's many types of honeypots. How a honeypot conceptually works is it has no production value. So anything going to it or anything going from it is a probe, attack, or compromise. You know the bad guys are on there. Makes reducing false positives, catching those false negatives much, much easier. If you're interested in learning more about honeypots, there's a website actually dedicated to just honeypots at tracking-hackers.com. Go ahead. Now, the advantages and disadvantages of this technology are is it really reduces false negatives and false positives because you're only capturing the bad guy activity. You're collecting little data, but data of high value. You really have minimal resources. A honeypot can be a Spark 5, 486. Conceptually, it's very simple. You just put it out there and anybody going to it, it's a bad guy. Major disadvantages. One, very limited field of view. If they're not attacking the honeypot, you don't see them. So if they attack another system and they don't attack your honeypot, you just missed it. So it helps complement your network environment. It doesn't replace anything. The other thing is risk. Honeypots have lots of risk. The honeypot can be used to attack other people. That's what we mean by risk. Mr. Salgado will be getting into that in a little bit. So what is a HoneyNet? It is what we call a high interaction honeypot. It have a high interaction in that we don't emulate everything. We provide real operating systems for the bad guys to bust into. It's an architecture. It's not a product. All right, it's not something you install and boom, it's up and running, going along. And then what you do is you create this architecture, this fishbowl environment. You put your systems in there and you let the bad guys hack it. You want Oracle on Solaris, put Oracle on Solaris. You want Apache on Linux, put it in there. You want IIS on XP, put it on in there. Then once compromised, we collect and learn all the tools, tactics, and motives of the bad guys. We sit back and watch. It's a big data collection system, but you have to hack it for us to collect anything. Go ahead. How it works, this network architecture, it's a highly controlled network where every packet entering, and as you're seeing, we'll see here in a moment, every packet leaving is monitored, captured, and analyzed. Any traffic entering or leaving the HoneyNet is suspect by nature because no bad guys should be going in or no bad guys should be going out. Makes data collection and analysis much easier. And all the technologies we're about to talk about now in reference to HoneyNets, you can also go to the website on the URL below. All the source codes there, all the config files, all the details. Go ahead. Now, a HoneyNet can be deployed many, many, many different ways. As Richard was pointing out here, organizations are using Firewall 1, IP tables, some people are using Cisco routers. So really what it is when we describe these HoneyNets, we're not going to tell you what technologies to use. We're going to tell you what requirements you have to fulfill, and you use the technologies you feel most comfortable with, or we do ourselves. There's really two critical elements called data control and data capture. data collection only applies if you have multiple deployed honey nets, like we do, because you have to collect the data from all the different honey nets. What we're going to focus on today is data control and data capture. Go ahead. Actually, let's go back real quick. Sorry about that. Let's go back. Back there we go. Thanks. Data control. What data control means is when the bad guys come in and bust into your honey net, you got to make sure that they can't use that honey net to harm other people. So we have to control what they can do outbound. You can't block everything outbound because they'll bust into your honey net. They can't go out. They figure out they're on a honey net and they blow it away. We've seen it. It's happened to us. Also, you got to let them go out and do some things, else you'll never learn. Never see IRC, download toolkits, shoot out emails, things along those lines. So the trick with data control is controlling what they do without them knowing they're being controlled. The other element is data capture. Capturing everything they do without them knowing you're capturing it. So controlling and capturing is actually relatively easy. The real trick is doing it without them knowing that you're doing it. Because if they're on the honeypot and they know you're on a honeypot, it has no value. Go ahead. All right, I'm going to lightly cover this real quick, and then we're going to shift into letting these guys talk. What I'm going to cover here is our Gen 1 technologies. This is the technology we used for Phase 1. We're now transitioning out of this Gen 1, our first generation technology. What you see up here is a network diagram of the honey nets we used to deploy. It uses first generation data control and first generation data capture capabilities. What you see in yellow are the actual honey pots. That's what you want the bad guys to break into. What you see the rest of is creating that fishbowl environment, that network architecture we were talking about. In the upper right-hand corner, you see that thing called firewall. That's what's allowing the bad guys to come into the network, but controlling what they can do outbound. So that's our data control mechanism, the firewall. And the router's doing a little data control also. The IDS system is our data capture. Remember, we had two requirements, data control and data capture. The IDS is our data capture. That dotted line to the network over there, that dotted line has no IP stack, so the bad guys can't see the IDS system. The idea is this. Bad guy comes along, he busts into the honey net, and he hacks one of the yellow boxes. Solaris, Linux, default. We used to do default installs. Now we're customizing. So the bad guys go ahead, they bust into those boxes. When they go in, the firewall allows anything from the internet in. It's kind of the reverse of the firewall. Anybody from the internet can come into our honey net. However, the firewall controls what they can do outbound. And how we do that in first generation is it counts outbound connections. They hack the Linux box, they go out to the internet. Every time they initiate a connection, the firewall counts it, and when it meets a certain limit, it blocks any more connections. The more connections you allow outbound, the more you can learn. The more connections you allow outbound, the more risk they're going to do evil things. DOS people, scan people, exploit people. So how many outbound connections do you allow? It depends on how much risk you want to assume. We normally allow maybe 5 to 10 outbound connections every hour or every day. Enough for them to go out and download their toolkit. Enough for them to go join IRC. Enough to send an email, but not enough to DOS whitehouse.gov. Not enough to go ahead and scan all the .edus or things along those lines. Believe me, they try it 80-90% of the time. So the firewall just counts and blocks. Crude, but very effective against automated tools, worms, script kiddies, because they go in, they do what they want, and they go right back out. Question?
Like it comes in, tries to quickly scan software, doesn't get any answer. They'll figure out what
the question was, is what happens when they bust in and they do more than 5 connections outbound, won't they realize they're on a honey net? Maybe. Majority of the time, they don't check. If you get an advanced blackout and they go out and all of a sudden they figure out a honey net, yes, they'll figure it out. That's why we've got Gen 2, and that's why we're going to be talking about quite a bit about it. Second generation technologies fix a problem he just identified. This counting is relatively easy to identify if you're looking for it. So that's why we're going to go into Gen 2 technologies here in a minute. This does work though, especially against the automated attacks. The IDS system is capturing everything off the wire. Question? We use all varieties, but the majority of the group uses Snort. One of the reasons is Marty's on the team. Jed's also one of the main developers of Snort. And in fact, he'll be talking to you in a little bit here about the modifications that will be coming in Snort 1.9 that are just made just for HoneyNet. So So we're tied in pretty tightly with Snort because it's open source, Marty's on the team, things along those lines. But you can use any other IDS system you want. However, we do not use the IDS system for alerting. Why would we want to be alerted when somebody comes in? If somebody comes into our HoneyNet, we know it's a bad guy anyway. What we use the IDS system is to capture every packet and every packet full payload so we can analyze all the packets at a later date. You're thinking, my God, you capture every packet and it's full payload? Yes, but that's only 5-10 megs a day at most because we're only capturing the bad guy activity. So that's our data capture mechanism. If you go to our website, we'll show you our Snort configs and things along those lines. So the bad guys come in, they hack those boxes, they do all sorts of neat, ugly, nasty stuff. Now, one thing we do, we have all the honeypots logging to the log service. We also log system activity. Bad guys hack the honeypots, then they try to go into the log server. Log servers are normally more secure, so hopefully we'll see advanced attacks. However, what happens if they break into the log server and destroy the system logs? Have we lost all the logs from the honeypots? No. Does anybody identify the second log server we have in that network? The IDS. The IDS system is a passive log server. It's passively capturing every packet on the wire, including all the syslog packets on UDP, is it 514?
Yeah.
UDP 514 that are sending to promote syslog server. So the IDS system is a passive log server. That's important to think about it. This technique's gonna apply to second generation. So first generation, relatively crude, but relatively effective against more basic threats. Automated tools, worms, script kiddies, people who don't look for this kind of technology. So what happens? They bust in, we capture the rootkits, we capture their tools, we capture their IRC chats, their emails. However, you have identified one major flaw. It's relatively easy to identify. The second major flaw, data capture. The bad guys use encryption nowadays. All of them do, even the critties. You don't have encryption installed on your computer, not a problem, they will install it for you. You see that repeatedly? You guys see it all the time.
They don't even use the SSH. If it's already installed, they'll install their own.
Yeah, because it's Trojan. So how do we capture their keystrokes from the wire if they're not clear text? We'll get into that. We're gonna straight some stuff in our second generation technology. Rather fast, rather furious. I don't want to go on Gen 1 anymore because Gen 2 is real exciting. If you want to learn more about Gen 1, buy our damn book.
We're not for profit, by the way.
Yeah, really.
But buy the book.
But I really want to get into Gen 2 because this is the first time that we presented this. Next slide. Okay. This just shows you how we do data capture, data control with the Gen 1 stuff. Rather crude. The firewall, look at rule number 4 highlighted in white. It's saying anybody from the HoneyNet tries to go to anything but your admin network, the production network, track with user defined, fire up an alert, and track what the bad guy's doing. We've done the same thing with IP tables too, but this just kind of demonstrates how the Gen 1 stuff goes. Go ahead. All right, Gen 2. I'm just going to give a quick outline, and then I'm going to let the hardcore geeks talk about how their code works, and then we're going to demonstrate it. The idea behind a Gen 2 is easier to deploy. You're going to see because we have data control and data capture combined on the same system. Also, it's going to be much harder to detect because we don't do the simplistic counting of outbound connections. We have more advanced methods for controlling the bad guys. Go ahead. Next slide. All right, let me just give you an overview. What you have here is, first of all, you see the second-gen HoneyNet. You see the HoneyNet sensor. It's a single system. It does both the data control and data capture. Much easier to deploy because everything's on one system. So where in the future we can actually come up with appliance or a bootable CD-ROM. 2, it's a layer 2 device. It's not layer 3. No TTL decrement, no IP routing, no IP stack, no MAC address. The bad guy will never see the firewall because it's invisible. It's layer 2. It's a bridging device. So every packet the bad guy sends to our HoneyNet or leaves the HoneyNet goes through our layer 2 bridging device without the bad guy knowing, giving us the ability to control and capture his activity without him ever knowing. Also, you can actually deploy this in a production network. The network you see in that diagram is a full Class C network. It's only the bridge that segments the honeypots from the rest of your production network. So your HoneyNets can be deployed more closely in the rest of the environment. A Gen 1 technology, what would happen is the bad guys would hack the systems and then they go out, they would count 5, 10 connections and then 5 any more connections.
We now have the ability, though, to go one step beyond that. Instead of blocking connections, we have the ability to block based on signature of modifying the attack. Jed, why don't you go ahead and talk about what you've done and how that works. Start off with an overview of the value, and then talk about how you do what you do.
Okay. Is this microphone working? Okay, great. I'm Jed Hale again. I've been working for about the last 2 years on gateway intrusion detection technologies. Our first attempt at it, I was done with Jason Larson, and that's Hogwash, which a lot of you have heard about. Some of you may have been at my talk last night. The basic idea behind a gateway intrusion detection system is you have full in-depth packet analysis. You can analyze the header, you can analyze all the flags, you can analyze the payload of the packet. You can do all the things you do normally with an intrusion detection system, but the same device also behaves as a gateway. So what that means is it controls which packets go back and forth onto your network by making more of an IDS-style decision. Hogwash did this by basically implementing the Snort intrusion detection engine. And Hogwash was a bunch of code we wrote that wrapped up Snort and gave it the ability to bridge, to do bridging, etc. It was a good first attempt. It works really quite well. A lot of people are using it. We're moving forward with the project, and one of the big frustrations we had with the Hogwash technology was I was stuck trying to backport stuff from the Snort project all the time back into Hogwash to try and keep up with what Snort was doing. It was a tremendous maintenance nightmare for the developers. So what I have done, and I've kind of officially announced it at this conference, is I've taken all the core gateway IDS functionality that you had with Snort, worked with the rest of the Snort development team, and we've merged all of the gateway functionality into Snort. So if in the Snort 1.9 CVS tree, we have inline Snort. I don't know if the merge has been committed yet, but I've got the diffs and they're ready to be committed. And what this gives you the ability to do is you use, instead of having to maintain, like for instance, a Snort distribution and a Hogwash distribution, you have the simple task now of just dealing with Snort. We extended Snort to be able to have keywords like drop. You know, so if the rule happens to match, you're getting at a drop. It has the ability, it does its linking up through IP tables via IPQ. So you have all the abilities that IP tables gives you also. Now some of the things that are most pertinent to the Generation 2 HoneyNets is, first of all, we have a lot of state counting mechanisms in there that keep track of what's going on with communication in and out of the network. And so we can do state counting, and we can detect the attempts to just do bold, outright denial of service attacks. We can detect the attempts to do port scans, all those things that involve hitting lots of machines really fast. We can detect those, and we can block them and prevent those from happening. Of course, that's something we could do in Generation 1 fairly reliably. That's not what we're really excited about. What we're excited about is the gateway IDS. Now we can write a set of signatures matching all the known exploits. And in fact, hopefully, if you're on your toes, you're going to catch the black hat real soon after he gets in the honey net. You'll know how he got in. You can write signatures to match what he did to make sure that he doesn't go out and use the same exploit on somebody else. And now, so the goal is, the second problem we encountered thinking about this is, okay, it's pretty easy to match the attack and then drop the packets. Again, you're going to alert the attacker quite quickly because he'll get a reset back, you know, and he may just think that the service wasn't there, but if he looked from elsewhere, he may know that the service was open and he'll get on to you. So the next thing we decided to do was add the ability to the HoneyNet sensor to change the content as it moves through the sensor. So in other words, you can write rules that will say, if you see this sort of exploit leaving the HoneyNet, alter the packet. Alter the packet just enough to break the exploit. So the exploit will hit, it'll hit the machine and it won't work. And that's the basic idea.
Think about it. With the Gen 1 technology, bad guy has to be locked. Bad guy goes out to the internet 5 times, 8 times, 10 times. Say he goes FTP, 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 FTP. After you reach that limit, you block any more FTP connections. With Gen 2, what Gen has done is this.
honeypot gets hacked, bad guy keeps FTPing up to the internet, we let him FTP as many times as he wants, 5, 10, 1,000, a million times. However, the moment he launches an FTP exploit, and that goes through our HoneyNet sensor, how do we know it's an FTP exploit? Because it matches the snort that's in your database. We allow the packet to go through the HoneyNet sensor. Our JEDS code twigs, just slits, one bit. So the assembler code goes through. And then when it hits the target, the attack's been disabled. So the bad guy is talking to the victim, it's just the packet has been modified. Question. Isn't there a high level of risk for these zero-day exploits? What if they use zero-day exploits on our HoneyNet and we don't throw out a signature for it? We, the HoneyNet project, say yes, and we can hear it excited. Why?
We got their wares.
Every packet payload, his source code, go to the tool, and everything. We captured it all.
I think the idea is to just show that you're attempting to do the most that you can, right? You really can't do much against Zero Day.
Yeah, you're right. The Zero Day will get through, and the Zero Day will do damage. We are assuming that risk. But for us, it's worth it because we can learn that zero-day attack.
Yeah, and I mean, nothing's perfect in these designs either. Like, it's always really interesting to see. I mean, the attacker can quite easily just attack himself with a known vulnerability, and if it gets modified, they can detect whether or not they're on a HoneyNet. So, I mean, there's lots of issues like that we have to sort out still.
What we're doing now is we're introducing the intelligence of looking at packets and modifying the packet. There's actually some other data control mechanisms we're going to talk about here in a minute, too. Question? Don't forget, in this virtual land, we control everything. Hell, we can go ahead and redirect it to another HoneyNet. Go ahead, hack it all you want. They think they're hacking some victims. Why do we have to lock up the internet? We can just go ahead and use DNet. You know, a destination map on IP tables, and that packet gets routed to actually another HoneyNet. They think they're hacking WhiteHouse.gov, but they're hacking, you know, our HoneyNet WhiteHouse.gov kind of deal. There's actually other concepts. Ed, didn't you write the paper on throttling?
Rate limiting, yes.
Go ahead and talk about rate limiting real
quick. Okay. Basically, one of the things that I wanted to include in my HoneyNet was, and share with everybody else, was the ability to, for things such as DDoS and other large flows that would be considered, you know, obtrusive and bad to have flying out of your HoneyNet on the outbound, I want to do rate limiting. And so what I've done is using basically either FreeBSD's capabilities or Linux's large capabilities, do basically traffic shaping to do per host rate limiting. And so what can happen is you get full functionality from, you know, somebody intruding into the host, they can FTP all their stuff. But what you can do is you can limit them down to, let's say, 64 kilobits per second full duplex or any combination there that you would like. And 14 to 4, whatever you want, yeah. And the end result is, if all else fails, so if for instance there were a bug in Snort or in whatever it is you're using, yeah, because bugs don't happen, right? I've never seen Snort crash. what'll happen is it provides a bit of a fail safe in that you can mitigate some of the bad things that can potentially happen by just basically rate limiting. And that way, if all else fails, you still constrain the pipe for each honeypot. And the interesting thing about doing it per host is if an intruder is logged into multiple machines, let's say on the net, on the HoneyNet, it's harder to detect because each honeypot is provided its own amount of capacity. So it's subtle and it works really well. Actually, I've had an incident where it was tested where there were some things that crashed and that was one of the saving graces. So it worked out really well.
Yeah, one other thing I'd like to add to that is with the new configuration using the inline snort stuff, it does fail close. In other words, the snort dies, the HoneyNet shuts down, which I think is a great thing. If they've come with some way to crash snort, thinking, okay, yay, now we'll evade any IDS, that's great. But they also just, you know, shut their access off so they can't do anything else while you're blind.
One of the things we like to do, too, is we're going to recover different types of Gen 2 data control. Which one is best? You actually don't use one. Multiple types. A
data control to protect against failure. It all comes down to how much risk are you willing to assume. We as a project are willing to assume more risk than probably most people here, because we want to see the OAs. We want to learn about the OAs. If you want to come and sue us, we have $1,500 in our bank account. Somebody
I'm filing suit.
Here. Their corporate account at Microsoft's a little bigger, so they're not going to assume quite as much risk as we're willing to assume. So we provide different ways of being control. The more data control you apply, the more risk you reduce.
It's less like a partnership.
It's up to you to know that balance. The Department of Justice has its own section here in the slides. I don't know, how does that make you feel?
I can feel the vibes.
But actually, Jed, why don't you go to the next slide to show us what we're talking about? This is your place option.
Oh, excellent. Okay. What we see here is a basic snort rule. I didn't know you had the slide. We're looking for what looks like some DNS traffic going out. And basically, you see a content line there. That's the content match against the Black Hat's exploit. And you'll notice that you can match whatever. You can match against binary content or whatever. If it's in the payload, you're going to be able to match it. And you can see here in the yellow, in the replace string, we've made a couple changes. We've changed to sled. We zeroed out some of the bytes. And also, they changed the path to shell. Now, another interesting thing you could potentially do is you could use DNAT. So when you saw an alert like this trigger, you could DNAT him and redirect him elsewhere, and perhaps even alter the path to point at some other executable. So there's a lot of fun things you could do with this sort of stuff. Perhaps you'd want to point him at some executable that would fire up something like HoneyD or something like that, that then could actually try and gather a little more data from the guy before he figures out what's going on.
So there's a lot of different options here. Doing some of them. But what we're most excited about, we do have the ability to modify the packets. So yes, the packets are going out and doing all sorts of stuff. But we're not just counting packets, we're looking at city interfaces. Yes, it's not working, it's okay. For us, we're willing to assume that risk. Now the question is, are you? Next slide. Let's go back one. Okay. The other thing, we don't have a slide out there because it's really so new. We just got the code working one last night.
We're doing data capture. Okay, I'm sorry.
Other big thing that we were talking about, can we go back to the network slide? Is data capture. How do you capture everything the bad guy does? How does the bad guy know? Especially since it's all encrypted. Well, what we do is we start kernelizing all of our blocks now. We capture everything in the kernel space. You SSH it, you'll capture all your key steps. You SCP it, you'll capture everything you've uploaded. HTTPS, SSL top, it doesn't matter because we capture it all in kernel space. These are explaining how to do all that stuff in it. I really don't understand kernel code. That's where we got Ed, K2, and some of the other guys here. However, with the honeypot, capturing that information is not key elements. Capturing keystrokes in kernel space is not new. However, we can't block it to the honeypot because the bad guy can see it. My honeypot, change, blow it away, leave. So the key element now is how do you can capture that information offloaded from the honeypot without him knowing? And you gotta do it relatively easy. Just hit the serial cable on the honeypot without it from the serial cable. Alright, you've got 30 honeypots. 30 serial cables all going to central system. Yeah, the serial cables work, but it's a pain in the ass. So, what Ed's gonna talk about here in a minute, what we're gonna general to you. Very relatively exciting stuff where we capture everything in kernel space. You see the honeypot? What he does is he takes all that information and just dumps it to the net. And what it does is emulates or spoofs net files, spoofs DNS, spoofs NTP. So the evil hacker will see these packets on the wire, but he won't know they're coming from his honeypot. The source IP address is the NTP server. Source MAC address is the NTP server. It's an NT guard. Or it's coming from that, that Windows XP box down on the network. somebody up. Hell, it doesn't even have to be IP, like DX, DECnet, Apple Talk, all these different types of things.
I just apply voltages.
The wire,
I just came with some wire. No. Morse code.
I've seen that.
Or carrier sensors.
What he doesn't realize is his key starts. It's the files and transfer. Now,
you have to get to a really
basic
level, I think, isn't it?
I don't know, there's a lot of these drivers in my mind. So now, you capture the data, and we can go ahead and offload it in a secure manner. The bad guy doesn't realize it's right in front of his face. It looks. Well, so that's just seen right now, but look, the board of this guy's white. So the idea is, it looks, it's in his face. Why don't you go describe how it works and stuff like that?
Yeah,
what would they find? Right now, if you look in it, we can show you, they'll find below Fisher's and below Fisher 2 Fisher.
It's encrypted, and it looks like random stuff. I'll try to get into that in a second. Basically, the motivation, like Lance was saying, was, a little while back, I'm firing up this new Gen 2 HoneyNet that I just got together, and like a kid on Christmas Day, I'm all excited. And so I fired up, and I'm not getting a whole lot of activity, and then one day over the weekend, bam, I get something. And of course, to my dismay, which is predictable now, I guess, is, somebody broke in and immediately installed their own version of SSH. I was kind of bummed because, I got a bunch of stuff they FTP'd, but I didn't get all their, all their keystrokes and stuff. I was sad. So I figured, I ought to do something about this. And so at the same time that I started looking at this, some other members of the project were throwing around some code that was basically going to solve this problem. And then so I immediately said, hey, that looks like something I want to help develop. And essentially what we have is we have a rootkit that we've modified. And essentially the modifications allow us to gather all system read and write data that we want. And we can, inside, we can configure to what we're looking for. That gets stored somewhere. And then we have a application that is sort of a, we've decoupled these to make it modular so we can switch out the application we use to export the data. But we have another application that takes that data that the rootkit logs and then puts it somewhere where we can get it. And essentially what we do right now is this thing spews it onto the network in an encrypted form, and it's able to forge, the source, destination, MAC, IP addresses, ports, all that. There's a variety of ways we can configure this and tune this, so we can make it, mimic, NetBIOS or whatever. We can also do things like just completely randomize the IP addresses it's using and MACs and keep them in pairs so we don't have any weird pair matching things going on. And then just basically just try to, what our goal with this initial version is to reduce the amount of suspicion of this traffic load down to a point where people aren't so motivated to just stare at the network traffic the whole time thinking they're on a honeypot. Because, the thing about it is as long as things are subtle, your chance of somebody is that paranoid, well, who knows, we'll see, But this is just the first version. The other thing that the export application does when it puts stuff on the wire is it introduces a certain amount of variability into how often it looks at the data and how often it exports it. And it also sends out null traffic. So basically, we send out decoys when there's no activity on the system. That way, independent of whether or not the person is, typing at the keyboard, or, I'm sorry, typing on their TTY or SCPing files or whatever, there's still activity on the network. And so hopefully there's just, level of suspicion is reduced some. The end result is there's also a third sort of system that was required, or I should say tool, and that is something to take this data off the network. And so that's also been developed, mostly by a guy named Michael Clark, who's one of our colleagues. And that is a really handy thing, because obviously it collects all the data and then puts in a log file. And so we can run n number of honeypots on a network. And what happens is this will collect all the data from all these honeypots, decrypt it, and then store it in a log file for each honeypot. And then we also have some parse scripts, and then you can take that and then process it the way we want. The net result of this is that we are able to fairly easily monitor any interactive TTY activity from an intruder, so we can see all the, you know, all the commands they typed, all the output if we wish. The other very, very interesting thing that I had a lot of fun doing was modifying it so that we were able to actually pull down files that are SCP'd and any other type of SSH activity. And depending on the direction, depending on where the SSH or SCP session is initiated, if the hacker is on a honeypot and SCPs a file to that honeypot, let's say they immediately break in with an exploit, SCP a file from their home machine back onto the local machine, we now have that file, and we also have their password. And that all gets that immediately then gets dumped basically on the network where we can then use it in our analysis efforts.
Is there a question over here?
Oh, I'm sorry. Do we?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, shoot. You can't tell the kernel module's there. We use a rootkit. We derive this from a rootkit. So the end result is the process that exports the data is hidden. The module we installed initially to provide the rootkit functionality is also hidden. We have discovered, and I should also provide this with, the rootkit itself is of course OS specific. So everything else is somewhat platform independent though.
We'll be porting to Solaris.
So the upshot is you know, there are ways of determining that something suspicious is going on. There are some weaknesses inherent in the rootkit. But our goal was basically to sort of, you know, flip the coin on the people that use the rootkits and take advantage, you know, why rewrite something? We basically just took it off the shelf rootkit essentially and tailored it to our needs. I'm fairly impressed with how subtle it is, and in it's not terribly easy to find it, but you know, if you're skilled.
Yeah, I think like sometimes you see guys going on there to try and secure the box so other people don't break in, but I don't think I've very often seen people going in and looking for, you know, doing rootkit, looking for rootkits and stuff very seriously.
Yeah.
Easy, we talked to Dave. You want to talk real quick, Dave?
Yeah, work in progress. That's, you know.
We're working with some of the folks at XP on that. Didn't even put you on the spot.
Okay. Okay. So. Well,
the thing that's in nature for a honeypot is going to be that it's in nature for any pot. Anchor comes in, the first thing it does is look at that you see the knowledge there. And one for it, you see that traffic is going to be a random
address. No. So you're assuming that he's asking, well, what happens if you see your random addresses? That's one of the options. But if it looks like an NTP traffic coming from the NTP server, CDP coming from the router, IPX coming from the Novell server.
Right now,
all that, good luck.
Yeah, well, one of the things that what I should have said to speak more precisely is when I say random, what I meant was plausible IP addresses from within the network range that is on, you know, we can tell it, use this range, you know, pull plausible IPs from this range.
Let's just go in depth, that might help some answers.
We can do that. You've got that fired up then? Okay.
There was a slide here to show you, it's something called virtual NX, this is part of the VMware, GSX. You have a Linux host operating system with another Linux operating system and XP operating system. So if you remember that diagram, go ahead and flip your slide in the diagram. Those yellow systems, the yellow honeypots, well, the window right here, this one right here, where you see here, that's a Linux honeypot. This is a Linux honeypot right there. That's the guy in yellow. We also have a XP box, Windows XP honeypot. And what these honeypots are doing are they're sitting behind that HoneyNet sensor, my Linux laptop. So what's going to happen now is Ed is going to SSH into the Linux honeypot. He's an SCDM file, and what we're going to do is the HoneyNet sensor is going to passively capture his keystrokes and help that upload the file. What you see in this slide here, right here, is right now we're capturing packets being sent by the honeypot. Even when there's no one on the honeypot, it's sending packets. So the packets, it's not like the IDS keystroke packet comes out. There's always the packets going out in 3 seconds, however you set it. Even when the guy's not doing anything, you're sending coming traffic. But it's not the packet after your keystroke, it's they're sending it first, however you set it, send it out to any lane. MTP is MTP, DNS, CDP, IPS, whatever kind of traffic it's looking like. Yeah. Why don't you go on SSH into the system? So what you're going to see now is he's going to SSH into the system. But you're going to all of a sudden see the snipper is going to be seeing the going in. So he's SSH into the honeypot right now.
Yeah, I'm going to run a command that will hopefully generate a lot of data.
What's that?
I'm going to run something that should cause that to...
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
No, notice he's on it. He's done a lot of...
Okay, there it goes, right there.
Now it's going ahead, and you're seeing packets of the wire. Our snippers capturing that activity. Go ahead and SCP a file up.
Okay.
You're going to go ahead and SCP a file to a honeypot. Meanwhile, from the network, we're going ahead and sniffing it. And if I go ahead and require on snort, snort minus V dash I VM net 1.
Okay. File's copied.
Just do it again.
Okay.
Boom, there you see it all going and stuff like that. And look what you're seeing is port 139 traffic because we got it looking like NetBIOS. So what he's done now is he's gone ahead and he transferred that information and we passively picked it off the wire. What we're going to do right now is to show you, whoops, let's go here, is how that information would look. So when they're right there, you look in the 192.168, I'm going to highlight that in white right there, that's the log file. That's the log file. Then Ed's created something called SPDump.
SPDump, yeah.
And the FC is 192.168, that one. Boom, we got all those keystrokes right there. And then what we can do here, actually, yeah, that's from the test. If you want the actual any files you upload, what is it, S?
S for any SCP files out of the log.
S. Boom. All right, it just extracted the GIF file. So he uploaded the GIF file.
So it's hoping you'd render the GIF
file. We're going to be demoing this at our booth all day today, too. So if you have any questions,
you
want specifics, come
and
you can see it.
Yeah. We got one question here.
Go ahead.
We could do it for every, but you get a lot of volume. So it's and as we go along, I still haven't got it nailed down to all we want yet, but it's an evolutionary process. So, but yeah, we do a subset right now.
All right, what we're gonna do now is shift gears and keep moving. If you're interested more in the details of the Den Gen 2 data control on the data capture, come on to our booth. We'll be more than happy to demo. Ed can show you all sorts of fun stuff. But we got some other stuff we want to go ahead and learn. Like I said, we are running this on virtual HoneyNet. We are on UML, which is Linux. So I actually have an entire HoneyNet on my laptop. And then also, real quick, why don't you talk about your wireless HoneyNet? PC. I don't think there's any slides.
In the past month, I've deployed in its infancy, a wireless HoneyNet in the DC area, consisting of about 5 access points, covering about, I would say, about 5 city blocks. Locally, the DC area. We have very similar technology doing the data capture and data control. Two things about what we're looking for on the network is that with wireless in general, we're not going to be seeing any like new exploits attacking like a Red Hat 6.2 box. That's not what we're looking for. We're looking at how people are currently exploiting wireless hunting nets in general. How many are out there doing it? Is this a widespread problem as you might think? Well, for anyone who's currently connected to the network in here, you should already be quite concerned about how
your packets are being sniffed right now is because I've seen some people in here sniffing up hop email passwords out just by, you know, sitting in here while you're in here. So that's one of the things we're looking at. We're looking at gathering statistics about how often someone is just driving by and accidentally either picks up your access points and attaches to your network, or is it malicious? Is this accidental? Once they attach to their network, are they looking for free internet? Are they looking for other machines on your network? Are they starting to push the envelope? Since we've been up, I have seen most people try to reach the internet. The HoneyNet in general right now does not have an internet connection. That is a decision that we're still wrestling with, because as soon as we connect it to the internet, we're essentially granting free internet access to anyone who attaches to the internet in the DC area. There's some concerns about that, obviously, with the data control side. You know, if someone attaches to the network and they just go straight out and starts pounding on someone, how do we throttle that down? So I'm looking into some of the NoCat auth capture portal technology to help us out there. There's a lot of guys around there, a lot smarter on the wireless stuff. Like Mike Schiffman had an excellent talk the other day about wireless that I sat in on. So I'm starting incorporating some of these technologies into the HoneyNet in general. Some of the things I have been finding, I've noticed that there's about two or three DHCP addresses handed out per day on the network. What these addresses are doing right now, it seems to mean nothing. Either they're just driving by, or just someone in the local five-block radius turns on their XP computer and accidentally attaches to it, but they don't surf out to the internet, or they don't. We don't see any of those packets. We have seen one ping sweep go through that just pinged off for the computers. I'm not sure if it's an automated tool or if it's a prelude to a malicious intent. But that is some of the things that we're slowly researching at this point. Question? I'm sorry, I don't understand your question. Oh, yes, I have varied turning off the DHCP server on and off. I have seen a lot of just random packets because it's 192.168 network, you see a lot of the internal networks with that. We have picked up packets maybe not directly intended for the network that we're sitting on. But as soon as I turn DHCP back on, I notice that there's more statistics that are generated for that specifically. And one of the things I am looking at is if it's malicious or non-malicious intent, if it's just a casual user versus someone out there looking for free internet. Nova Wireless is probably out there looking right now, because Security Focus just did an article on it. And I've been on RFMON, which is a Nova Wireless net, and they've been started talking about going out and hunting this little honey net down, trying to find it so they could get free internet access. So those are some of the things. We're still in infancy. I'm still learning a lot. I have a very small crew working on this, and we're looking at how to increase logging mechanisms on wireless networks in general. To do that, it is very difficult to log anything on a wireless network. Just by default, anyone could anonymously attach to the network and do whatever they want. If you sit outside of Starbucks or Apple Store, you know what I'm talking about, or even in here, except unless you're being sniffed and you aren't using encryption. So I'm going to go ahead and press on this. If you have any other questions, I'll be out at the booth outside as well. Just come up and hunt me down and fire away.
Like I said, this is going to be fast and furious. Is all this legal? I don't know. Ask him.
I'm Richard Salgado from the Department of Justice Computer Crime Section. One of the things I do for the section is pay attention to honeypots and take a look at the legal angle at it. And then the other thing I do, of course, is try to convict Brian Martin in conferences. This is my contact information. Really, I'm only allowed to be giving legal advice to government entities out there. So if you are involved in government work, or you are a individual who works for one of the agencies, feel free to contact me, and I'll be able to give you a little more specific advice. The point I want to make today about the legal side of honeypots is really simple. Consult legal counsel before you put something up. And that's it, and I can sit down, but I'll probably elaborate a little bit on that. it is untested. We haven't seen prosecutions. We haven't seen civil suits involving honeypots. But there's, you know, there's sort of a general feeling, I think, among you folks and among HoneyNet and some other folks who've been out there with playing with the idea of honeypots, that there may be something different here with regard to honeypots than regular production servers. There's just, things seem like this is slightly different, and maybe the legal rules regarding honeypots are a little bit different as well. And I'm going to talk about the possibility that that is the case and some of the areas that we see as being potentially implicated by honeypots that might not otherwise present such a problem. The three main things I'm going to talk about: one, the Federal Wiretap Act, which is a statute that prohibits, it can make it a felony to intercept electronic communications while they're transiting through the network. The second I'm going to talk about is some potential civil liability issues that may be heightened when you're talking about a honeypot as opposed to a regular production server. The third thing I'm going to talk about is something known as entrapment. And there's always sort of, I sense a queasy feeling on the part of people who are putting up honeypots about, well, is this really right? Am I inducing somebody to do something they shouldn't be doing? And am I going to get in trouble for that? And hopefully I'll be able to shed some light on that. But these really are things I'm going to talk about to highlight for you to be able to go to your council and say, these are some things I'm worried about, and you get your advice from them, because I am most certainly not your attorney, nor am I these guys' attorney. All right. See, I say that way I get to keep my license to practice law and my job. The Wiretap Act. The Wiretap Act is a federal statute. I'm sorry? I'm not up to date on my slides?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm not going to talk off those in there. These are mine.
There's no slides.
Huh?
Richard, do you have slides that you want to...
No, okay. There's really three points. You can, I'm sure, keep track of this without slides up there. Wiretap Act. The prohibits the interception of electronic communications and can be a felony. There can be civil liability as a result of doing it. It's a general prohibition, and it often catches system administrators and security folks by surprise a little bit to know that it really can be a problem if you're watching traffic on your network. So there's this general prohibition, you can't do it. Thankfully, Congress gave us a lot of exceptions to the Wiretap Act so that folks who are in certain situations are allowed to watch the traffic on their network. Well, with honeypots, that's exactly what you're doing, right? The whole point is to see what's going on in the network and in fact, see everything that's going on in the network. There are three exceptions to the Wiretap Act that potentially apply to make it legitimate and legal under the Wiretap Act to watch the intruders that are coming in. Now, this kind of surprises people because they think, well, these are hackers. These are people who are attacking my machine. Do they really have this sort of right of privacy to what they're doing? And the answer is, well, Congress passed this act that does generally give people the right of privacy in their electronic communications, even if they're unauthorized. There's nothing in the statute that says that it only applies to people who are authorized to be on your system. So we do start off with that premise that this could be illegal. So then we start looking to the exceptions. The first exception to the prohibition against watching traffic on your network is if you're doing it to protect your system. You're watching the traffic because you're trying to protect your system from hostile attack, from criminal activity, from somebody stealing the information or looking at information, getting, you know, the privacy implications of somebody on your system. If that's your motive and you're authorized to be watching the traffic in your organizational structure, then under the Wiretap Act, it's okay to be watching those communications. It's an uneasy fit for honeypots, though, isn't it? Because this is an exception to protect your system. Well, why are you putting the system out there? To be attacked. So you're watching the attackers in order to protect the system that you put out there in order to be attacked. So it's a very odd fit. And we haven't seen it play out in a court. I don't know what a court would say to that. But it seems odd to be saying, you know, I'm trying to protect it, but I'm really kind of wanting people to hit it. Yes, sir. Right. That would be the argument. The question here is, well, and I'm going to rephrase it and tell me if I got it wrong, but but we are trying to protect our system in a more of a macro way. I've got this honeypot out here so I can learn of zero day, I can learn of these vulnerabilities that I may actually have on a production server, and by learning those things I can tighten up my production server, and therefore by watching these communications I am in fact trying to protect my production server over here. That is an argument you might be able to make. And I think the argument gets stronger the closer your honeypot actually gets to your production server. So if your honeypot is actually picking up certain siphoned off type of suspicious traffic that otherwise we would be headed to your production server, you have a better argument to say, well, it actually is there next to my production server trying to protect it, therefore I'm properly employing this exception to the Wiretap Act. If it's just out there all by itself and you don't see a production server near it, it's a little weaker argument, but maybe it flies. You're saying, well, I'm just generally trying to increase my knowledge of security, which is going to protect my production servers 10 years from now. I don't know if a court's going to buy that, but there's some squishiness here. I think that's true. Yeah. The disclosure of the interceptions. If the question is about the sharing of the information, even if it's acquired legitimately under the Wiretap Act, if it has been legitimately acquired by under the Wiretap Act's exception for the provider protection exception, you can disclose it. There was no violation of the Act, and there's no problem with disclosing that. The second exception, if that doesn't work, there's another exception that might work, and that is the consent of the party or one of the parties to the communication. Right, so that sort of makes sense. You can, if you're on the telephone, you can give consent to somebody else listening in on the telephone under the Federal Wiretap Act, and there's no problem there with them listening in. Same thing with electronic communications. If one of the parties to the communication says it's okay to intercept the traffic, it's okay. Well, who are the parties to that communication? You're going to have your attacker. It's possible to get the consent of that attacker through banners, right? So if you've got a bannered honeypot that says, by using this system, you're consenting to our intercepting or you're being monitored, there's consent. So that's one way to get consent. Yes, sir. Yeah, state law can be different. Some state laws have what's known as dual consent or all-party consent, which means you can't intercept communication unless everybody on the system or who are involved in that communication has consented to that. So then you got to make sure that everybody, like if you're trying to keep track of a chat, everybody has consented to your keeping track of that chat. So what I'm talking about right now really is just federal. And on the federal side, one-party consent. If you're going to set your honeypot up in a particular state, you're going to want to make sure your council checks into the Wiretap Act's laws for that particular state. Yeah. The question is, well, what about the computer that is the honeypot? Isn't it a party to the communication? Ah, that's a good point. Maybe it is, right? Somebody's connecting to my computer to store files on it. You've got one party, the person's trying to send the files. Who's the other party to this communication? Maybe it's the computer, it's the honeypot, and you can get consent from the operator or owner of the honeypot to do the intercept. That probably works, and there's some case law that talks about that. Now, it gets trickier if you're just being used as a pass-through, right? Hitting, coming in, laundering IP address, and going out again. Are you a part of that communication, or are you just the telephone switch operator that, helping plug through the connection? Then it gets a little trickier to rely on the system owner as the party to who can give consent. Yeah. The question is, if the attacker is in a state law where the law is different than where the honeypot is, am I aware of a case where the state authorities have tried to assert jurisdiction and say that even though you intercepted it in a different state, our laws applied and you violated our laws? I do not know of such an action. Most of the statutes actually, the place of the interception determines what law applies. I'm sorry, what's your... Same answer. It's going to be the point of interception typically decides which... yeah, but we don't, in the United States, we can't, for example, enforce our wiretap act for an interception that's happening in Canada. So that's right. Yes, sir.
Those lawful are also violated by the defendants.
Say it again?
You can make the log file also violated by
the defendants. A log file that's keeping track of communications in general would be an interception of communications, arguably, and thus you're going to need an exception to the Wiretap Act to do so. Usually system protection exception or consent would be the system administrator's basis for doing that. I'm running a little short on time here. I guess I'll hang out at their booth, as bad as that is for my reputation. The third exception that applies at times is what's known as the computer trespasser exception. This is an exception that applies, typically where this really applies is where somebody has intruded into your system and they're not authorized to be there. And in some situations, the system administrator, where this happens, this is sort of outside the honeypot context, doesn't have the means to do the monitoring and would say, government, will you please come in and monitor this intruder? Government can come in and monitor that intruder. And there's no violation of the Wiretap Act so long as the person coming in is unauthorized. This can apply, we think, to honeypots, where everybody coming in would be unauthorized. And thus, if you had government doing the monitoring, or if it was a government honeypot, there would be an exception to the Wiretap Act. All right. The third topic I wanted to talk about was civil liability. Think about what happens when you put this machine up and the possibility that it's used as a platform to attack other machines. A plaintiff's lawyer for a downstream victim of your honeypot, so somebody who's gotten into your honeypot and attacked, may want to argue in a civil court, look, this guy put this honeypot up here knowing it was going to get broken into, hoping it was going to get broken into, intending it was going to get broken into, and then it was, no big surprise, and used to attack me. They should be held liable for having that happen. So it may be that there's a heightened level of potential for civil liability in the honeypot context than there isn't in a production server context. I don't know if that's true or not. I can just see this play out. Okay. That he had a vulnerable machine too, so it's sort of... All right. One of the other problems is, what if your site is used to store contraband? You suddenly start finding a wares site pop up. You find stolen credit cards. You find child pornography. Bad situation. It takes a lot of time to monitor what's really going on your box. And you take that a step further. What if you start finding, okay, now your honeypot's being used to distribute these items? So you got to be careful to watch what is happening. And not just because you might get in legal trouble for that, you might, but also because it just, as a matter of public relations, especially if your honeypot's associated with an enterprise, that's an awful price to have to pay as well. My final point I wanted to hit briefly was this concept of entrapment. Because people a lot say, well, are honeypots right because you're entrapping people into hacking? Let me just tell you, entrapment really is a very, very narrow legal doctrine that applies in criminal cases as a defense for defendants. What defendants will argue at times is, I would not have committed the crime had government not induced me to do so, right? I was not going to commit the crime unless government caused me to commit the crime. It's a pretty narrow defense, and it's only one that you assert in a criminal proceeding to get off of the charges. So for private entities who are running their own honeypots, entrapment really, in that sense, doesn't make any sense. A private entity can induce somebody to commit a crime without it being entrapment for a later prosecution. Now, for a government honeypot, it's conceivable that there would be an entrapment issue, although it's such a difficult defense to prove, especially in the context of hacking, that we haven't seen anything close to that.
What we can do, too, is if you have slides, we'll put them on HoneyNet.
Okay, yeah, we can supplement the HoneyNet slide with the slides I've got here that didn't make it into the presentation. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, if you just stick your honeypot out there, it's hard to see where the entrapment is. If you put your honeypot out there and then take all sorts of active measures to try to attract a particular person to it, to the point of inducing it, that's when maybe, I think it's still unlikely, but maybe that's where the thought of entrapment would come in. But it's probably not an issue for most private honeypots. We need to move on. But thank you. I'm happy to talk to you after this.
He'll be around.
We'll be around. We did this reversers challenge. Essentially, I'm going to go through here pretty quick. I got a bunch of things. We've got the binary that we released. It was found on a HoneyNet. It's a remote backdoor. It uses network encoding. It's not cryptographically secure. What it essentially is, the DDoS agent does a lot of stuff like that and a backdoor. It was statically linked. That proved to be a moderate inconvenience for reverse engineering the functionality of this thing, but... Yeah.
Okay.
Really. Challenge background. It was judged by a panel. David Dietrich, Job Dehas, myself, Halvar, Hera, and Niles Provost. Niels. We essentially got this binary, put it out on the net, invited security professionals or whomever under the sun to analyze it, attempt to understand the functionality and everything else like that. These are the questions we put forward. Essentially, what is this thing? What does it do? Why is it functioning in various manners? Can you identify, any special components within it? Essentially, to gain an understanding of the tools, methods, techniques, which ways got you the best sort of mileage in terms of reverse engineering, and I'll talk to you a little bit about that. Here's some of the network traffic that we also sent out. As you can see here, it's some data. You can pretty much guess it's encoded. This is encoded data that was sent here. Some people even wrote like snort decoders or post processors, which would decode all of this on the fly and then match it to signatures. But as you know, it's pretty clear that it's not cryptographically secure. You can see this obviously some nulls here that generated this obvious pattern. And that's another thing about HoneyNets. We've got this data and it's very easy to analyze and people can actually look at it. By and large, we've got just a few packets every now and then in comparison to lots of traffic. Here's the decode via that snort plugin or post processor or what have you. Here again, the lessons learned. We wanted to understand the thought process. What was the most economical way of doing things? What possible misdirections are found when you're analyzing binaries, things like that. I calculated these up. I essentially took the most senior challenger, if there were multiple people in the group who challenged, and summed up the total time it took them to do things and their experience. A lot of man hours were spent. Someone was telling me that this is, they figured they could just do this as a denial of service on the security community, like put out just funny things, and lots of people spinning their cycles, So the most successful challengers used static and active analysis. If you do a static analysis via not running the binary and just looking at the bytes, you're going to have a fairly good idea of what's going on, highly detailed and whatnot. It's a lot more time consuming though, and you can augment that with an active analysis to sort of pinpoint critical sections of the binary and then kind of work inside out. A lot of people kind of were static, then they went to active, and they never went back. I kind of, for speed, for time's sake, they only had a month to do this. But, I think both of these techniques should be used fairly in conjunction. There's a lot of tools. I know people like to hear about tools and websites and URLs and stuff. Michael Zielinski's got this webpage for Finneris for other, and it's got a huge list of reverse engineering tools and stuff. Standard console utilities were used quite a bit. I'll just burn through here. Active analysis, UML, some people tried to use that. It's deadly easy to escape a UML though. I wouldn't recommend using a UML for anything other than just testing configs and, when you're not dealing in a hostile environment, essentially. Standard debuggers, Some of these things, you know, it's double fork, kind of freak people out. Most people just would skip over that section or knock those calls out or something. A lot of tracing utils, the alphabet soup trace, you know, sys trace, truss, whatnot. Fenris was good. It's got this utility dress. Again, it was a statically linked binary, so it was convenient to remap the symbols so that you could identify the actual code of the binary and not waste time playing around in, you know, shared libraries. Here are a number of other tools, if you're kind of interesting, it's been around forever, but the names are somewhat meaningless, and you know, it's just takes the C, I mean, assembly converts it to C, but it doesn't have much to the easiest thing to understand. Various, yeah, Perl scripts and things like that. Commercially supported tools, I might show, I was going to try and show a little bit of IDA stuff, but I mean, if you graph it, I was going to show that too, that you can really easily identify the core processing loops and see precisely the sections that you would want to reverse engineer and understand. Essentially, VMware is really interesting. Some people use Source Insight, kind of source browser to download, you know, map, download the source for libc and then sort of map the source to the binary. It was kind of interesting, kind of time consuming. Post-processor, client applications, people kind of, as they went along to test their theories, would develop tools to interact with this daemon as it ran. Also, there were various techniques to rebuild the libc symbols, like unstrip. Challenger 32 essentially made this tool. It's pretty interesting. It's kind of like Dress for Fenris, but it's kind of standalone. I think we're releasing all of these things so everyone can take a look at all the analyses and whatnot. Yeah, it's all online. And you know, it would go through and attempt to he went and downloaded the binary libc's from all kinds of distributions, and whoever had the most matches in terms of the signature would win in terms of the most, you know, closest libc to the one that was statically linked in there. There were very few discrepancies when he was pretty precise with his analysis. Again, static, we don't actually run the binary. It's difficult to trace in complex applications, so that was a bit of a drag in certain circumstances. You know, and then you've got all of these compiler wrappers for syscalls, you know, where it's a couple of functions deep. So, you know, you don't want to waste time figuring out, oh, this is just the setup code for set socket or, you know, sig action or what have you, sig whatever. Active, you know, the code may be destructive, so you got to look out for that. That, you know, might be handy to do a little static analysis and look for, you know, troubling things like, you know, a lot of people marked that, you know, the, you know, they had a percent s, you know, or sh-c percent s, so they knew that there was some kind of command execution going to happen arbitrarily, and they, you know, didn't want it to RM their whole system. Again, you can quickly identify important sections of the application. So you run it and you get to a critical processing loop, and then you can start and go inside out, sort of just ignore everything else and just hope that that wasn't important. I mean, if you're really in a pinch for time, I think one guy did this in like 11 hours or something stupid like that. So that's one way he went through there. You know, theoretically, if you do that, though, also the code path can be accurately identified, so you don't waste time in obfuscated code or, you know, anti-reversing, anti-debugging tricks, you know, or, you know, obfuscations. Not many people did a pure static. That really isn't the best way to go about things, I don't think. You know, you spend a lot of time. You got to be real pro, really, to go through that. Again, the fastest time, leveraging a combination of both. Many people reconstructed the C binary. Now, that really, as you go along, helps you solidify your assumptions. And it was really interesting to see some people reproduced the C code so precisely that it was better than the original. I mean, they would. It was really interesting. You know, they have to go back there and reread this, and there were actually bugs. It was interesting. There were bugs that were in the binary and bugs that were in the C code that were generated, but some people actually didn't spot the bugs. So you've got to kind of go back and analyze everything that you've got, every little bit of information, more and more. Eliminate static code. I mean, that wasn't really a big deal. And the network decoder was extremely poorly written. One thing that kind of helped out was that there was a decode and an encode function in there, and they were inverse of each other. And I think the encode, or was it the decode? One or the other was coded a lot more simplistic, and that sort of gave people hints at, you know, what was really going on. The encoder was just going all over the place, and it was tough to identify exactly what it was doing. Strings analysis, you know, that will get you strings. You know, that might not help all the time. Fingerprint analysis, you know, fingerprinting is good, but, you know, again, obfuscations might thwart that. Algorithm identification, from being able to identify magic numbers, random number generators. If you can see, like, DES, like, encryption blocks in there, you know, then that might tell you what's going on with that. You know, syscall identification, that's pretty easy, although it's trivial to thwart. You know, in essence here, we're going to jump over this fake move here and trick out a lot of the Ubu tools. You can even fool IDA. We can get around. This isn't exactly set SID. That's actually, what was that? Syscall 2. That move 42 never actually executes, but IDA thinks it does. So you've got to look out for tools. And, you know, if this was a really advanced guy, he would have defeated